benefits of music. Dr. Mellis, you've got a segment for us on the benefits of music at the very start of life.
Well, what a beautiful way to bring this in from Zara's presentation at the other end of life. And it underlines that, in fact, music goes throughout the whole of the life cycle. It's not the other end, it's actually the continuity throughout life and indeed throughout generations. I mean, historically, 4,000 years ago, lullabies, for example, were documented to be sung back then in papyrus and various other documents. And so the question would be, that we start with, which I could ask, why do we think music is so universal that babies and mums throughout the world have almost identical lullabies, despite their different culture, language, heritage, and history? The lullaby has a basic structure. Why would we think that's so?
Soothing.
It soothes.
It's naturally,
yes.
Soothing. Now, and it pre-exists language as a communication.
Yes, and so why should that be soothing and before language? A lullaby. Because you can hum it. You don't actually have to have the rock-a-bye baby. You can actually hum it. Well, basically because it mimics the rhythm in the womb.
Oh, I wouldn't have come up with that.
Because there is the most fundamental rhythm in the womb, which is the heartbeat of the mother, the breathing. And from 24 weeks on, a fetus actually hears at 4,000 megahertz, which goes up to 20,000 for the birth and adult. And so there's already from 24 weeks onwards this constant internal rhythm of the heartbeat. And naturally it speeds up with a bit of excitement. It goes down with sleep when mum's sleeping, hopefully a very restful sleep through the whole night. And also the conversation that goes on between mum and whoever's around. And indeed, if mum's listening to music, that will offer its own vibrations. And there's some experiments that babies recognise which music they heard in the womb afterwards in preference to non-heard music. So it's an extraordinary basic soothing innate, exactly, it's an innate rhythm. And one or a couple of people have actually said this is an acoustic bridge between, for the rest of our lives, between what we experienced internally in the womb and the external world with its noises and disjunctions and disharmonies. And so singing actually brings us back to our very core.
An acoustic bridge, what a
yes.
Beautiful phrase.
And acoustic is really one of the fundamental senses that we overlook. And in fact, people who are tragically given, you know, the question of which is the most fundamental sense you'd like to preserve, vision or hearing, many would actually preserve hearing, surprisingly, because it resonates to so many deeper places. And language obviously would be lost, which is a fundamental communication. And so music is essentially a communication. And this is part of the reason I mentioned earlier that carers who are next of kin have got that acoustic bridge from even before birth. And so there the body is used as the platform from which to resonate. And it is no longer just what's audible outside with the voice and the harmony and so on, but in fact the baby actually resonates in their body, as does our whole body resonate when we sing. And if you are with opera singers and you put your hand on their chest, you will feel the most incredible resonance going on, because they're just bellows, the two lungs, and everything resonates to go get the air past the vocal cords. Now, this being the case, the question arises, so if it's soothing, what else does it do? Because it does a lot more. That's fundamental to get the baby to lull, hence lullaby, to go off to sleepy land. But it also gives some other profound quality to the carer. And that is, it often expresses the carer's mood. So a mum who's upset is unlikely to do tra-li-la-la, happy traveller, but will do another more subdued lullaby as a way of sharing her mood state with the baby. And the next day when she's got an upbeat anniversary, birthday, whatever, she will go tra-li-la-la. So the baby's already introduced to mother's diurnal, or if you like, daily fluctuations in her mood expressed through the lullaby choice that she gives. And so it's an educational rhythmic acoustic bridge that isn't static, but like some bridges that you've got, lift bridges, you know, allow different things, ships of sizes, different sizes to pass through. So here we have already a relationship between mother and baby resonating and attuned. Now this is in the ordinary situation. Now Zara raised the question of what happens actually in the brain, because this I actually didn't know when I mentioned about my own experience with my dad in 1995, 1996, 1997, the last few years of his life. This was not known. So this is actually all new knowledge in the last 20 or so years. And I discussed this with my mum, who was also a carer for my dad. We have different attitudes towards music. She is not really a singer as such, but she's an extraordinary carer. So there are many dimensions to caring in the relationship. However, the common factor between her and I caring for my father was that we didn't use much language. And so this is what has been the revolution in understanding what the brain does. That is to communicate from the right brain to the right brain. And lullabies are in fact pre-language. The words are there sort of for icing on the cake, they're dressing. But the main issue is the repetitive rhythmic harmony. And so all lullabies have this quality of repetition and usually very few words. Because it's not about getting the baby or the toddler into an encyclopedic knowledge of, hey, I can talk. In fact, they can't talk. And indeed, the first language in all our lives is a body language. And therefore, the baby, and indeed anyone who later on is traumatized or somehow disadvantaged, is resonating to these non-language centers. Now, why do I raise this? Because a new book has just come out, literally in the last month, called The Alan Shaw Reader, edited by a German psychoanalyst, Eva Rass. And it is the mapping of what we now know on the course of development. The cover, which we can put up later, is actually of the London Underground. And it has little puppet figures which highlight symbolically how, depending upon where we get on an underground train, determines in a large part where we're going to end up. However, it's not predetermined by fate. We can change stations at Waterloo, and there's about four different endpoints depending on which one we change over to. And tellingly, the foreword for this amazing book is a preface by Sir Richard Bowlby, and that should ring a bell, because he, of course, is the son of the famous John Bowlby. And he endorses the book extraordinarily graciously by saying that Alan Shaw has often been called the American version of John Bowlby, but now there's a question of whether he should be called the Einstein of development. Now that's no small accolade, but it is not misplaced, because Alan Shaw actually is at the forefront of the pioneering work on how we understand the brain works in extreme states as well as normal development.
You're listening to Radiotherapy on 3RRR, and we're talking with Dr. Malice about the importance of music and melody at the start of life for infants, and about a new book that's just come out that speaks to brain development at that age as well.
And what this new book's message is that we have been thinking about music and stress and trauma and the reparative, therapeutic effect of music in a very outdated mode in the previous paradigms of understanding brain function. Essentially, what he says is that the fundamental way we function is in fact pre- or subverbal. And this is what he emphasizes, the right brain to right brain communication. Now, it happens in poetry, not through the words, but through the rhythm of the poem. It happens in music, not through the lyrics. Of course, that adds a little spice and flavor, but the basic essence, the ingredient, is the very stuff of the rhythm and the prosody. And prosody is, in fact, what mums all have innately. And so you don't need to train most mums. When their baby's upset, they will coo. They won't have a big lecture, come on, pucker up and get going. They'll say, oh, you poor little baby. Oh, that hurt. Give me the wow wow. Oh, I'll kiss it better. And then, of course, the gesture goes with it. And so it's the cooing and the gesture and the body language that the baby picks up on, which is repairing the wow-wow, the hurt. So we have really got a new way of now looking at understanding stress and upset and trauma for children and infants, and indeed adults and dementia sufferers, that it's not so much what we lack or what we hurt by, but what the carer offers to repair that state. And so he talks about the reparative moment and the reparative relationship. And this, of course, is what we take into the choir or in our therapy. Hopefully, we don't become leadened therapists, you know, just rolling out off-the-shelf interpretations. We're alive to the moment. We're there with the patients resonating. We're providing the acoustic bridge for their dissociations. But of course, that's another story way outside the realm of choirs. And this is really the message that Alan Shaw's reader provides for the ordinary person. And the reason, just by the way, why a reader? As it's well known, if you've read Alan Shaw's, you don't really quite get it the first 24 times you read it. And hence, Eva Rass has provided this reader, which makes his life's work accessible and just so much sense. And so I recommend this, obviously, because it's one of those great landmark books.
Can you tell us the name of it once more?
The Alan Shaw, S-C-H-O-R-E, Reader, Setting the Course in of Development, edited by Eva Rass, R-A-S-S, published by Routledge, 2018. So it's hot off the press, and it is one incredible reader.
Miss Medic.
One of the things that came to mind when you were talking, Malice, was about my own experience as a mother. And my eldest child, who's now 8, on a day where she might have had a bit of a rocky day or something emotional has happened, she'll often ask for this bedtime song that I used to sing to her as a baby, yeah, as she's having a cuddle before she goes off to sleep. Mm-hmm. And I think that really speaks to how powerful that is, that connection to the song that I used to sing when she was an infant, which often she doesn't need now because she's a big girl with lots of other ways of soothing herself. But on a particularly hard day, she'd still ask for that song.
What's the song?
It's a Twinkle Twinkle Little Star with some added verses come up with by myself, because as many parents will know, when you have a baby, you don't often just sing it once.
No.
And when you're singing it and you're still going, we have several verses that are specific to my children.
Well, it's
and
specific
I actually wrote
to you.
Them specific to me and yeah, my kids. And I actually wrote them all down a couple of years ago thinking, I hope I never forget these added words to this song.
Absolutely. Now, I would just add, that is just such a heartwarming story, isn't it?
Yeah.
That I would say, although, bless her, she's 8 years old, and you say she's got lots of other coping mechanisms, my guess is at 16, if she has a broken heart, she will still be your little baby and will want Twinkle Twinkle. And when she's before her marriage, she will still want mummy to sing Twinkle Twinkle. And when she in her time becomes a mum and you become a grandmum, Twinkle Twinkle be a family heritage.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a very beautiful thing. And you're right in that it came very innately. It wasn't something that I thought about doing. It just happened. And, you know, it's speaks to that very special connection.
Now, that happens. Special connection also can be likened to an emotional umbilical cord.
Mm. Yeah.
And really, preserve that for the rest of your lives. It is just such
that's
a blessing.
That's my intention.
Yeah. And that's what I keep thinking about as I hear you talk as well, Dr. Mellis. It's about those moments where we actually stop thinking, you know, our kind of that part of our brain is switched off and we're not trying to achieve something. We're not thinking our way through this dilemma and trying to fix it. We're just in the moment, in that felt sense. I think that's what music really helps us tap into.
And when it's shared, either with one person or in a choir, it is so much more than the sum of its parts. Mm. It takes it into transcendent places. I mean, whatever language you wish, whether it's meditative, transcendent, sacred. But I like the idea. That's a sacred mother-baby space.
Thank you for that beautiful segment. I feel like all our conversations today are linking in so well. And before we go today, there's one more thing that we want to tell you about. In preparation for our